Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, April 2nd, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho Senate approves Medicaid budget today. Reproductive rights advocates gather in Pullman over the weekend to further Trump-proof Washington. And Washington Governor Bob Ferguson still against wealth tax proposal, breaking with legislative Democrats. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House this evening passed the higher education budget for the state with $2 million in cuts each for the University of Idaho and Boise State University. The budget now heads to the governor's desk. The $4 million total in cuts are based on the presumption that the two universities are still promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion in some of their programs, although the universities are not required to completely eliminate discussion of those things, just eliminate all DEI programs, as the State Board of Education ordered in December. Republican Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow spoke on the House floor in favor of the budget, and he said the cuts were not meant to be a punitive hit. Mitchell said, "As I drive through the campus, I see a lot of Trump stickers. I see a lot of pickup trucks. It really does have a very conservative feel. It really felt good to know that our kids out there are very conservative. They're at a great school." Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston, who also represents District 6, which includes the University of Idaho, said the universities had made the cuts to the diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and when asked, had closed the University of Idaho Women's Center, which was considered DEI. McCann says, "It's really disappointing to me that we would punish them when they cut out all that we asked them to cut out." McCann voted for the bill because she wants the budget to get passed, but she spoke at length against the cuts. The budget passed 64-2 with four members of the House absent. The representatives who voted against were Republican Representative Kyle Harris of Lewiston and Republican Representative James Petsky of Meridian. The Idaho House today approved the state's Medicaid budget for the 2025-2026 fiscal year, totaling $5.2 billion in state and federal money. The legislature had already approved the maintenance budget for Medicaid, totaling $4.6 billion. Today's vote was on the remaining $600 million called the enhancement budget. That includes money for moving the entire Medicaid management contract to a third-party managed care organization, as required by House Bill 345, which the legislature passed in mid-March. Republican Representative Josh Tanner of Eagle voted against the budget, saying lawmakers should have made more reductions, such as reducing the provider reimbursement rates. Republican Representative Clay Handy of Burley said the budget reflects the increasing cost of health care. Handy said, "All of these people in health and welfare, all these people in need, some unemployed and some of the working poor, these funds are just the fact that's what we owe. It's what it costs them to remain healthy." The vote today was 40-30 in favor of the budget, which sends the budget to the governor's desk. The Senate approved the budget Monday on a 22-13 vote. The president of the Idaho Senate transmitted the bill that would specify which flags can fly on government buildings within the state to Governor Brad Little's desk yesterday for his possible signature. Governor Brad Little now has until next Monday to either sign or veto the bill or let it become law without his signature. House Bill 96 would only allow government buildings to fly the U.S. flag, state flags, indigenous tribal flags, military branches, and the POW/MIA flag. Recent amendments to the bill permit official flags of countries other than the United States to be flown for special occasions, and official flags of Idaho's colleges, universities, and public schools. Although the bill is clearly aimed at gay pride flags, bill sponsor Republican Senator Ben Taze of Coeur d'Alene denies it. Taze told the Senate, "The ultimate goal is for us to fly flags that unite and don't divide. It also eliminates the potential liability from the reality of viewpoint discrimination." Democratic Senator Melissa Wintrow of Boise said, "I think this is one more bill that targets the LGBT community as trying to erase and silence them. I think it's 25 bills we're up to this session that attack the LGBTQ community. Regardless of how many bills you throw, you will not erase them. They will still exist. All you're doing is making it harder for us to survive." The bill passed in the Senate 22-11 with four senators absent, which is not a veto-proof majority. It passed by a larger percentage in the House, 54-13. Both House members from District 6, Brandon Mitchell of Moscow and Lori McCann of Lewiston, voted in favor in the House. District 6, Senator Dan Foreman of Moscow voted in favor of House Bill 96 in the Senate. Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador called on the Idaho legislature to override Governor Brad Little's veto of Senate Bill 1023, which Republican Senator Dan Foreman of Moscow in District 6 sponsored. The bill would ban Idaho businesses and education facilities, including schools and daycares, from engaging in any kind of medical intervention taken to diagnose, prevent, or cure a disease. That would include sending home a ill child. The bill would prohibit businesses from requiring medical intervention such as vaccines as a condition of employment or as a condition of entry to a venue. Supporters of the bill, Attorney General Labrador included, say the bill would protect the rights of Idahoans and uphold what he calls medical freedom. In a letter defending his decision to veto the bill, Governor Little listed other controversial bills he signed into law this legislative session, including the ban of mask mandates by local governments and health districts, and the bill allowing healthcare professionals to refuse treatments that violate their personal beliefs. In an email, Governor Little wrote, quote, "Calling Senate Bill 1023 medical freedom is a total misnomer. Idaho already boasts the most medical freedoms of any state in the union, and this bill works against parental choice. Parents deserve to send their children to school or daycare knowing they will be safe from contagious illnesses that disrupt families' lives." Attorney General Raul Labrador has a history of opinions about health care. In his initial campaign for office, he largely ran on the state of Idaho's COVID-19 response. This was when he ran for attorney general in 2022. In particular, Labrador decried former Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin's defense of Governor Brad Little's emergency powers, which consisted almost entirely of a one-month shutdown and included no statewide mask mandates. He has since fought doggedly in defense of Idaho's regressive abortion ban that enables the state to prosecute physicians who perform abortions and convict them of felonies, and which offers no clear emergency exemptions. To override the governor's veto, each legislative chamber must pass the bill by a two-thirds supermajority. Republican House Speaker Mike Moyle of Star told the Idaho Statesman Saturday he does not believe the Senate, which initially passed the bill 19-14, will be able to reach the veto override benchmark. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. We'll be back in a moment.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Palouse Prairie Charter School, an EL Education accredited expeditionary learning model school serving students in northern Idaho. PPCS is a free public charter school that combines hands-on learning, rigorous academics, outdoor adventure, and character development. PalouseProairieSchool.org. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Moscow Contemporary, which connects, supports, and creates community through art and arts education. Moscow Contemporary is located at 2012 West Pullman Road and moscowcontemporary.org.
Washington Governor Bob Ferguson broke with Democratic legislators' budget proposals in a news conference yesterday. The state faces a $16 billion budget deficit over the next 4 years, and a recent publication from the state's Office of Financial Management forecasts an $845 million revenue reduction over the same period. One of the key proposals from both House and Senate Democrats is a new wealth tax. Governor Ferguson said he will not sign a budget proposal with a wealth tax. Ferguson's opposition to the wealth tax is in part due to its questionable legality and in part due to the risk of fielding untested policy in uncertain times. The governor said, "We can and we must prepare for even greater cuts from the federal government. We need to accept that we are in unprecedented times with the federal government that is intent on making significant cuts, no matter the resulting harm to Americans." During the last two-year budget cycle, Washington received $34 billion in federal funding for Medicaid, $2.5 billion in federal funding for education, $1 billion for child welfare, $600 million for disaster response, $304 million for unemployment insurance, and $864 million for temporary assistance. Officials expect the federal DOGE project under Elon Musk to attack each of those line items. Governor Ferguson noted Washington is one of the states most dependent on international trade and will be among the hardest hit by tariffs. Former Governor Jay Inslee, as part of his mandatory outgoing four-year budget proposal, indicated approximately $3 billion in potential cuts over the four-year window during which the state is facing its $16 billion shortfall. Ferguson has since increased that figure to $4 billion, a move which he says will preserve Washington's core services. Though lawmakers have yet to provide a full budget proposal ahead of the Sunday, April 27th, end of the 2025 legislative session, Governor Ferguson's vision seems to enjoy bipartisan support.
A bill known as the Act for Civil Engagement did not make it out of committee in Olympia before the deadline, but advocates for people who are incarcerated say they are not giving up. The act would ensure people in Washington prisons and other facilities are able to form political organizations, communicate with community groups and elected officials, and access spaces for meetings. Karen Pesey was formerly incarcerated and now works with the advocacy group I Did the Time. She says when people behind bars are able to stay engaged in politics in their communities, it reduces recidivism.
They feel like they're a bigger part of society and an important part of society because they're helping to make it better.
Backers of the bill say more incarcerated people have submitted virtual testimony in Olympia since the pandemic, but the process could be more accessible. PC says people are being punished for doing political work from prison, and the bill would prevent such retaliation. The Washington Department of Corrections says implementing the bill would have cost more than $26 million and require over 100 more employees, rendering it too expensive. PC says the DOC already has the infrastructure in place for people in prison to communicate online with politicians and organizations. She thinks the bill would have been important for the mental health of people in custody.
You need to keep active. You need to keep your mind engaged. That's what creates a lesser evil within the prison.
Supporters of the bill say it follows other legislation that passed in Olympia last year. The Nothing About Us Without Us Act guarantees that legislative groups would include at least three people with direct lived experience of the issue they are working on. PC notes many incarcerated individuals have been part of the foster system or experienced abuse or a lack of support, giving them valuable insights into improving systems to reduce crime rates. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Seven reproductive rights advocacy groups gathered over the weekend in Pullman to strategize and organize the next steps for pushing back against the recent attacks on reproductive justice. The keynote speaker at the Reproductive Justice as a Human Right Forum was pro-choice Washington political manager Paul Dillon, who shared his experience working to Trump-proof Washington between 2015 and 2020 and how he helped Washington become one of the most pro-choice states in the country.
When I started in 2015, this is when we started to see the attack videos coming out where people were pretending to be journalists and secretly recording providers and, you know, putting out these really exploitive and dangerous videos. And we started to see in Congress from our previous congressional representative, Kathy Morris Rogers, I think an increase in dangerous rhetoric that really paved the way for, again, I think a lot of the lies that we see that are so normal today. And this resulted horrifically in the firebombing at the Pullman Clinic here in 2015. And again, we saw the community come together, rally for support, show a lot of care for patients and providers. But this really did, I think, show, again, kind of what was at stake and where things were going and taking a much more dangerous turn. And, of course, in 2016, with the election of Donald Trump, who pledged very clearly to overturn Roe v. Wade, it sent us kind of in a new direction. And when I say us, I mean I was working at Planned Parenthood, but also Pro-Choice Washington, the Northwest Abortion Access Fund. How we really came together in spaces like these with intersectional advocacy. And what we did and kind of helped make Washington so Trump-proof was going back out to community and listening. And we held action forums across Eastern Washington right here in Pullman to really kind of focus on what we should be focusing on and hearing from communities at the ground level. And we developed these kind of four pillars of advocacy, and that was, number one, protecting and expanding abortion access, protecting and expanding sex ed, protecting and expanding birth control, but then also how we work for movement building and intersectional advocacy. So this was immigration. This is police accountability. These are all the different things that we know impact patients' lives. So in 2017 in Washington State, and 2017 doesn't seem that long ago, and it's hard to remember, Republicans actually had control of the Senate. And we were a pretty purple state. Once the Senate flipped in 2017, we never looked back. So a lot of the laws that you heard about earlier, such as, you know, our amazing insurance coverage for abortion access, that was the Reproductive Parity Act, and that meant that if a provider was covering maternal health care, they had to cover reproductive health care. And this is something that we had tried for 5 years to get passed. And when that finally passed, it felt like a door had opened. And it, after these conversations and looking at different policies, we passed the Reproductive Health Access for All Act, which made sure that gender-affirming care was covered. It created a fund for undocumented patients to seek reproductive health care, the first kind of legislation in the country to do so. And then passed a new sex ed bill that made sure that sex ed had to be inclusive, medically accurate, science-based. And there was a referendum to overturn this law, but that law was upheld with 60% of the vote, sending, I think, again, a very clear message about where Washingtonians stand on these issues.
That was Pro-Choice Washington political manager Paul Dillon speaking at the Reproductive Justice as a Human Right Forum held in Pullman Saturday. Dillon referred to the still unsolved 2015 firebombing that destroyed the Pullman Planned Parenthood facility. It has since been rebuilt. The person behind the conference and all the breakout sessions and workshops was Intersectional Advocacy Coalition Director Diana Whitney.
And we try to promote the whole idea that everyone, by virtue of being human, has these rights. The forum that we put together today for reproductive justice is an effort that was a couple months in the making. We started in October, I guess more than a couple months, and we pulled together various student organizations, community organizations, and other organizations across the state to have this forum here today with lots of wonderful people coming to share their experience and their knowledge. We've had a good turnout, and I guess the one thing I'd like to have people take away from this is, well, two things. One is that there are organizations in our community you can reach out to. We're trying to get that word out. And so remember Intersectional Advocacy Coalition. The other thing is that they have power. We feel often very powerless in our community, especially these days. And I'm hoping that the attendees here have been empowered to act.
That was Intersectional Advocacy Coalition Director Diana Whitney. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox contributed to this story. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, we are looking at 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms before midnight tonight, then a chance of showers after 5 a.m. Snow level 4,100 feet, lowering to 2,700 feet after midnight. Partly cloudy, low 31. For tomorrow, we're looking at a 30% chance of snow showers before 8 a.m., then a chance of rain and snow showers before noon, then a chance of rain showers. Snow level rising to 3,700 feet in the afternoon. Partly sunny, high 49, northwest wind 5 to 15, gusting up to 20. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Thursday night through Sunday, mostly clear weather, low 30 Thursday night, highs 54 Friday, 59 Saturday, and 65 on Sunday, lows 31 Friday night and 35 Saturday night. Current temperature is 45 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option. And there's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. David Katz and Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online. Coming up next, Flashpoints, followed at 7:30 by Lockdown Mosh Pit. Music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades with Arlene at 8:30. Scooters, The Inner Side, coming up at midnight, and more to come after that. Stay tuned. KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP, Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. Available online at loveskombucha.com.
For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.